On March 16, a terrorist walked into two mosques in the New Zealand city of Christchurch, the town where I was born, and began killing Muslims in prayer. At the end of this hate-filled rampage, 50 people were dead and another 50 had been injured in one of the darkest days in New Zealand's history. In the aftermath, it had become known that the attacker was an Australian man who had aligned himself with far-right extremism, white supremacy, and Islamophobia. In the days following, as the world grieved, Australia began to grapple with the question of how one of our citizens could have developed such hatred, racism, and prejudice. In this episode of The Good Vote, we continue that conversation, and there's nobody I'd rather have by my side for it than my co-host, Mr. Tim Costello.
Thank you. Thank you for that deference. I want to introduce Susan Carlin. Susan is an academic, author, has a PhD from Monash, and she's lecturing there. Susan's a regular thought leader in print, radio and TV media. She's been named as one of Australia's most influential female voices and a Muslim leader of tomorrow by the United Nations Alliance. It's an absolute delight to have you here, Susan.
Thanks for having me, team.
Yeah. Now, Susan, you're a prominent Muslim woman and your husband is probably Australia's most prominent Muslim man.
I thought you were going to say another prominent Muslim woman. I was going to say, hey.
Well, no, he's not.
Okay. No, that is correct.
Look, are you able to share with us how you felt when the news of the Christchurch attack first came through?
I think it was just horror. You know, especially now with the 24-hour news cycle and everything's updating so fast on Twitter. So there was just little drips of information coming through. There was a shooter at the mosque. And, you know, when we first saw that, we didn't know what it could be. It could be a Muslim who just went crazy at the mosque. We had no idea what could be going on. And then as more and more information came out, It just got worse and worse. So many people have been killed. That had gone to another mosque as well. Mm. It just, and also I have, you know, my family's from New Zealand. My mum's a Kiwi, so family there. And
is
I have
that right?
Yeah.
I'm a Kiwi.
Yeah, and now you like me.
Oh. I know I liked you before. I knew there was something really nice about you.
Something inherently good.
Yeah.
So that, you know, obviously I have a special connection to New Zealand, and then of course I have Muslim friends in New Zealand as well.
Right.
So it was just horrific to watch it unfold. And then the more we knew, the worse it got.
Yeah.
I think for everybody, it was just so deeply horrible and distressing and scary.
Yeah. I know that my family who were there, and I rung my mum and I was like, Mum, there's something going on. And she didn't really know. Because, you know, almost when you're outside of it, you don't hear about it. Like if something was happening here now, we wouldn't really know, but someone reading the news. And I rang my mum and she's in the supermarket just 1K away from the second mosque. And I'm like, Mum, might be good for you to get home now. And she was like, oh, you know. And it was horrifying to think it was so close to people that we know. And anyway, that's just a side note. But look, we just wanted to ask you as well about you converted to Islam as a teenager.
Mm.
So how did that come about? What happened there?
I think it was when I was 17. I just started to wonder why I believed what I did. Is it because it's what I think is true or just what I've been raised to believe? And I think that's often the age that a lot of people start to go through big existential crises. You know, because I eventually became Muslim at 19, and that, you know, I was in first year uni, and that seemed to be the age that, you know, my friends were joining the Socialist Alliance or becoming vegetarian,
you know,
or political parties at the uni. You become quite idealistic and you're sort of throwing off the trappings of your family or your parents and what do I think, and the world is bad and it needs to be better and I'm going to be part of it.
Yeah.
And so I guess other people joined the Labour Party and I became Muslim. But it was something that I really resisted, I think. I didn't want to become Muslim per se. I thought everything I knew about Islam looked horrible. But I think intellectually it sort of appealed to me first. The more I read about it, when I sort of tried to stop listening to all the noise and sought out what does the faith seem to be saying about itself, as much as a religion can speak for itself.
Mm.
It was very different to what I thought and very appealing.
When you went home and said, Mum and Dad, I've become a Muslim, what was the reaction?
They weren't thrilled. My mum gave me a hug to her credit, but I knew she was really upset. And again, as a parent now myself, I can only imagine if one of my kids came home and said, I've joined this thing that you don't know much about and what you do know looks horrendous. I'd be quite concern too. So I can understand. At the time, I was like, gee, Mom, just let me live my life. But now as a parent, I get it. And, you know, we've sort of gone through this journey. I've been Muslim now longer than I haven't been.
Right.
And so we've sort of gone through that together. My mum in particular has sort of learnt more. I've kind of calmed down a bit. And so I think, you know, we're both at a really good place.
Yeah, right. What do you think is the biggest misconception about Islam and about Muslims? I mean, I know that's very big.
Where do we start?
I know, we've got 24 hours.
I know, sorry, this is only a 20-minute podcast, but maybe just a quick overview of
Oh, there's heaps. It's funny because I'm good friends with Michelle Laurie, who's a very practicing Buddhist, and it's funny, she says that the negative stereotypes people have about her are really good in that they're, you know, if she ever lies or swears, they're like, oh, you're Buddhist, you're not meant to do that. So it's a bit... The stereotypical idea of a Buddhist is, you know, perfect and saintly, whereas the stereotypical idea about Muslims are all just horrendous, like that we're murderers and, you know, we just, even the ones who seem quote unquote good, we're just silent sleeper cells waiting to take over. The women are all oppressed and the men are oppressors and the women are oppressed but we're also secret jihadis. Just, it's all negative.
Yeah. It is all negative. And Tim, I know you wanted to ask a few questions.
Yeah, so listeners may know something of the five pillars of Islam. I'm interested in zakat and giving. What is that? So Christians have this idea of a tithe and 10%. Yeah. What does zakat mean for you?
So zakat is like, it's like, it would probably actually be better to call it a tax because it's an obligatory charity. So it's something that Muslims have to give. It's not optional. We have to actually give it. It's meant to be 2.5% of our accumulated wealth above a certain point. So if someone's very poor, they don't have to pay it.
Right.
So from a sort of a minimum threshold. And you're giving it to the poor and needy. It doesn't have to necessarily be Muslims that you give it to, just people who need it. They're a criterion. And the idea is that that money isn't actually ours. It belongs to them. And so the idea is that when we give it, it's actually purifying of our own wealth. By giving it away, it helps sort of purifies the wealth that we keep. But that we should never feel very good or holy for giving it because it actually belonged to them. It would be an injustice of us to withhold it from the people who it belongs to.
Right.
It's fascinating, you know, sometimes Christians I meet who have Islamophobia, you know, I say to them, well, who actually is concerned about pornography or marriage breakdown? The answer is Muslims. And whether it's a tithe or zakat, there's so many parallels. I mean, do you look back on your pre-Muslim days and say, yeah, there are parallels?
Oh, unbelievably. Undoubtedly. Like, I had such a wonderful, positive Christian upbringing. It couldn't be faltered. When I was younger, I went to a Uniting Church. Then I went to a Baptist church and I had the most amazing role models. Like it was the flawless Christian experience that I wish everyone could have.
Wow.
And so they were just so giving and good. And I still reflect back on the youth leaders I had as a teenager and think, how would they act in this situation? And so, of course, there are so many similarities. And for Muslims, we sort of think, well, of course there are similarities because we feel it comes from the same source. Yeah. Like it makes sense to us that, of course, the same God would be sending the same message.
Yeah.
But I think part of the problem is, and this isn't just unique to the Muslim community, that when religious leaders seem to pipe up in the media, it so often seems to be about horrible things. Like, and I think that's why religious people in general have such a bad reputation, that it is very rare for us to see a Christian politician put up their hand and say, what I really want to do is look at our laws about how can my Christian religion influence my policy on climate change or homelessness, for example. Instead, we see it about them trying to stop same-sex marriage, you know, those sort of things. And we just, religious people come across as horrible bigots.
And
that's across the board. And so I can understand why people who don't have a religious conviction or connection just think, why would any of us want any part of that? We never seem to be standing up for the good stuff.
We're known for what we're against, not what we're for.
And
I mean, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's in London, got into big trouble in one of his books when he said, the God of Jews, Christians and Muslims is the same God. He went on to say it's different faiths, but it's the same God. And he got beat up for that. I was fascinated you said Christian and Muslim, same God.
Yeah, and Jewish people as well. We think exactly the same thing. Like, so sometimes people come and say, well, the stories in the Quran are very similar to the Torah or the Gospels. You just copied. And we say, well, our explanation is all of these prophets were coming with the same message from the same God. So, of course they would be similar.
Yeah. Mm. As Christians, we're used to hearing people who don't share our faith take verses out of the Bible and misuse them. Sometimes it's extremists who call themselves Christians who are using them to justify doing hateful things, like Westboro Baptists. Mm. I don't know if you've seen them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's non-Christians who are trying to make the point that the Bible is outdated and irrelevant. Is that what happens with the Quran?
Yes, it is.
Oh, who would have thought?
And I think, again, that's the thing is that these issues within religious communities and also the way our religious communities are perceived, these are human issues. This is a human grappling with these big issues. And so, you know, Westboro Baptist, I think, is a great example. They're kind of like the ISIS of the Christian world.
Mm. Right.
I mean, they're not killing people, obviously, and I'm not trying to minimise that.
No, I get it.
But it's the same, you know, Westboro Baptist would be adamant that they are purely biblically based and have a biblical justification for everything they do, doing horrendous things, protesting funerals and the signs they hold up, horrendous. Yeah. In the same way that, you know, ISIS would be like, absolutely, this is Quranically based and this is how we justify it. But then how can you get ISIS and the Persian poet Rumi reading the same religious text and coming with such different interpretations? Mm. Or Tim Costello and Westboro Baptist. It's the same text. Right. And this is why, as we were talking about earlier, in the end, religions don't speak. Religions do not speak for themselves. Humans bring their lens and all their background and baggage and all these things to these, what we believe obviously is divine texts. And then we grapple with, well, what is the divine really saying here? And of course you're going to get a multitude of different interpretations, some great and some horrific.
Mm. And the extremes that Christchurch threw up at one level, that great replacement theory, there's a white genocide going on, we've got to fight back. It's a fear right at the heart of it. I'm minded Gandhi said, we think the enemy's hate. The enemy, the real enemy is fear. Fear of the other. ISIS seems to have a fear of religious contamination and their way only. The great replacement, the terrorist of racial contamination. I mean, does faith speak to fear?
I think it should. I think, you know, if I look at it from a purely religious point of view, I would say that sincere faith can't exist at the same time as fear. Mm. If we truly have faith in God, then we will, it will help obliterate the fear. Mm. These two feelings can't exist in the same vessel. And that's not to belittle any religious person who struggles with fear. Of course, we all do. Mm. Mm. So it's not a condemnation that, well, you're not just being religious enough. But I think more it's a calling to us that when we feel that fear, to remind ourselves is, well, who is it that we worship? And what does that God say about themselves? And when we reflect on that, then it sort of evens out the scales.
Yeah.
Mm. Look, I know speaking to some different friends and things, asking them, I was telling them I was going to be talking to you and just seeing what questions they would ask. And one of the main questions that came up was about wearing a hijab. Is that how you say it?
That probably nailed it.
Yes! So, I mean, was it your decision? Is it required? Why do you wear it? Do you have hair? what colour is it? Yeah. Like, I know these are really random questions, but I think,
I get them all the time.
Right? And yes. I feel like even just some of these minor things can contribute to Islamophobia. We don't know why, or people don't know why. And why do you do it? Why do you have to do it? Like,
absolutely. And I think when there is the question that people either can't get an answer to or don't feel they can get an answer to, that's when they just fill the vacuum with their own ideas.
That's right.
And that's when, oh, well, obviously you wear that because your husband makes you.
Right. And
that
people are fearful of asking you that question or asking a Muslim that question because it's so like,
well, yes, I have hair. I still have hair under here. I don't wear this all the time. I don't wear it in the shower. I don't wear it to bed, believe it or not.
Right.
And The thing is, if you ask any Muslim woman why she covers her hair, you're going to get, you know, a whole host of different reasons. It might be cultural, you know, in their culture it's really common. It might be political. It might be a feminist statement. They might say, you know, I live in a society like Australia where women's bodies are always used or always commodified. They're used to sell everything from screwdrivers to pencils to chewing gum. This is me making a stand against the male panopticon gaze.
Yeah, right.
But in the end, what I think it should always come down to is that the way men and women dress, Muslim men and women dress, is it's an act of worship. So in Islam, it's the idea is that any mundane act can be made sacred with the right intention and the right awareness. So it's kind of the sanctifying of the dress. And modesty is, in behaviour and in dress, is a big part of Islam for men and women. And that's quite countercultural at the moment. It's not really a good thing to be modest. It's seen as outdated, it's seen as repressive, even in terms of behaviour. You know, if we look at our social media world, it's the antithesis of modesty. It's about self-promotion and that we have to do it and people need to know what I'm doing and it's my performed existence. So it does seem a bit weird and awkward to people. Well, why would you cover? Like, why would you do that? But for me, you know, it is an important part of my faith, but it's not one of the five pillars, as you said. It's not, doesn't make you not Muslim.
So you don't have to wear it.
No, my mother-in-law doesn't wear it. Right. A lot of Muslim women don't. Like, obviously, we're talking in a context where women have a choice. In some countries, they don't have a choice. Right. They are forced to wear it. And that's important that we reflect that. But also, it's important to remember that in some countries, they're forced not to wear it. In certain countries, women are not allowed to wear it if they want to. Well, if you wear it, you can't come to school.
Right.
So, and that, both of those situations I feel deeply uncomfortable about because that's where women's bodies are being used as a political battleground.
Right.
I love that I wear it as an act of worship because I think humans are made for worship. I think we will end up worshipping something. It might be sex, it might be power, it might be money. We actually, I think, are made that way. And it strikes me as fascinating that philosophy might be fine answering the question of why in my head. When it comes to religion, it has to be in our body. There has to be the bowing or the kneeing. I still kneel and pray because that's incredibly important for my sense of both submission and honouring. In terms of worship, maybe just talk to us what that means for you.
Well, so there are the obvious, very understandable acts of worship, you know, the five daily prayers, for example, where, you know, as you were saying, it's the mind, body and spirit are all in submission with the movements we do. And obviously we have Ramadan where we fast for a month. So those are the obvious acts of worship. But as I said, ideally in Islam, everything would be an act of worship if we have the right intention and if we are conscious. So there are prayers that we can say before we get dressed, before we eat, before we take a journey, before we start the car. And it to some people that might sound quite immature or, you know, why do you need all these rules everywhere? It's for us, I suppose, it's about a constant reconnection to God, to the divine, that, you know, our human nature seems to be a forgetful one. We constantly sort of drift away from God. I don't think God goes anywhere. I think we do.
Yeah.
So it's a constantly bringing ourselves back and reminding ourselves, kind of like checking the compass. Where am I going? Looking at our map again and again and reminding us that, where am I going? What is my intention in doing this? In getting dressed, what's my intention for this? Walking into this interview, what was my intention? And I think we can never really know our true intentions, you know. And that's okay. That struggle is okay to grapple with. I think that's part of the human grappling with the divine as well.
It's almost, I mean, listening to you speak, it's like Christianity and Islam are very...
You're struck by the parallels, Mel.
I am struck by the parallels, and I feel like that there's no need to have Islamophobia when it's, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like people just don't know.
But can I say, I think a big part of the reason for that is if you look at all of our conversations about Islam, it's talked about as a political identity. Right. So people will always ask about jihad or what's Sharia or why do you wear hijab. They never ask about the religious stuff. How is Islam a spiritual guidance? What is the religious manifestation of it? And so if we're always talked about it as a political ideology, then of course people won't connect with it as a religion.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think, you know, it's sad, but I look at some of the media interviews I did 20 years ago.
Right.
The conversation has not changed.
Right.
The questions haven't changed. Mm-hmm. And I think so long as we're sort of stuck in this same groove of the record player, it's never going to progress.
Is it helpful? Some people are picking up, we don't talk if there's a terror act about Islamic terror, but Islamist terror. Do those things help, or are they cosmetic?
My husband did his PhD in political science and political violence, so he would say yes, it's very important that, you know, we use the right terminology and words have meaning. And I think, you know, at that sort of high level, absolutely. But I think for the average person on the street, if you ask someone walking past now, how does an Islamist differ from a Muslim? They would have no idea. None at all. Like, they'd be, I guess it's the same, Islamic fundamentalist, maybe they're all the same. Like, they wouldn't have a clue. I think there is such low level literacy about Muslims and Islam at the moment. And it's a tricky one for the Muslim community, because I know, particularly post September 11, the Muslim community feels they've been working incredibly hard to try to change the narrative. But in the end, only 2.6% of Australia is Muslim. It's a tiny fraction, which means the average Australian will never have a Muslim friend, neighbour or colleague. So their sole source of information about Islam is the media.
Yeah.
That's it.
And most of that is ISIS and the burqa ban and Halal is actually funding jihad. And that's it. They're not, you know, getting to know just Muslims as people.
That's pretty fundamental. I read a review commissioned by Jews after the Holocaust saying, why were there some righteous Gentiles who didn't collaborate, who protected us? And the main finding was those righteous Gentiles were people who actually didn't know Jews as abstractions. They knew a neighbour, a colleague, someone at work, and that changed everything. It seems to me you're saying much the same thing.
Right, which is, on the one hand, it's great because we know people as people and we can connect as people, it seems to have quite a good vaccination effect. Mm. But as I said, when there's only, you know, 600,000 Muslims in Australia, what do we do now?
98% of us want to befriend you, so.
Yeah, exactly. But
overwhelming.
So when that's not feasible, what do we do?
Yeah. Look, I mean, that leads to this question that I have. Is it really, and I don't want to offend anybody by this question, but is it really possible for Muslims and Christians to be friends? I mean, at the end of the day, both sides believe they've chosen the right religion. So will that always get in the way of genuine friendship?
I don't know. I don't think it has to. Like, I have a lot of genuine, sincere respect for Tim. Like, I would never be like, well, he's, you know, chosen the wrong path. It wouldn't even enter my head.
Right.
It just can't. I think when you are very secure in your own faith, you're not threatened by other people's. There's no sense of unease.
Right.
So and that includes if people have no faith. Like, I feel no sense of distress about that. I guess it also because it comes down to your perception of God. And I believe God is sincerely good, and I also believe God is totally just. So I never have to worry that the wrong thing will happen, you know, in the next life, that something cosmically will go wrong. Like, I can let God be God. And, you know, I think there are certainly times in history where we have seen Muslims and Christians and Jews live relatively amicably, you know, very different political climates. But I think if the will is there, there is no reason for it not to exist. We don't have to have everyone be the same as us to like each other.
That's right.
And I think we are so in our own silos at the moment, and we're so in our own tribes. It's the worst it seems to have ever been. Mm. And if we can just let go of this idea that you have to be exactly like me for us to get along, then there is no problem.
You sometimes see the best of it when there's crisis in West Africa with Ebola. Because the burial practices are passed on the infection, we, World Vision now, had imams going into Christian churches and saying, we need to bury quickly, and pastors going into mosques. Mm. It brought the community together in a powerful way. In Afghanistan, we have a program, Channels of Hope, which is using the Bible in Christian-majority countries to protect women and children. We did that with imams, with the Quran, what the Quran says about protecting women and children. When an imam was criticised that World Vision, a Christian organisation, was doing it, he said, no, Allah has sent them to us. And you have these wonderful stories of hope to say, actually, we don't need to be always irreconcilable.
That's right, yeah. Look, we're coming to the end of our podcast, but I want to just give you the opportunity if you wanted to say anything about, you know, Islamophobia or, you know, anything to do with anything. I don't know.
Well, I've actually got a great Pavlova recipe I want to share.
Funny you should say that because I wanted to share. No.
I don't think so. I've loved the chat.
Oh, good.
It's been a really fun chat.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, Tim, why don't you – do you want to wrap us up? Any thoughts?
I just want to say thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
I think both the tone and the content of what you said for many of our listeners will be not just refreshing but even surprising. And
absolutely.
I think, you know, the vulnerability and humility you've shown is really wonderful.
Oh, that's
thank
far
you.
Too kind. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming in and just sharing your insights. I know for me personally, it's been really insightful.
You're shocked to know I've got hair.
Okay, I didn't want to say that, but
tell the colour, though.
No. You want to know how you know what colour a Muslim woman's hair is? You just look
eyebrows?
At her eyebrows.
Right. So it's kind of like brownie blondie, kind of. Listen, I wouldn't mind wearing a hijab, then I wouldn't have to do my hair. Is that something
but that's... then you get bad hijab day, see?
Oh, really? Like it doesn't go on properly and you're like, and dang it.
Exactly the same.
Is there a hijab shop?
Is there? This is a whole other episode.
Sorry.
This is a whole other episode.
But there is. Is there?
Shops. Like, it's a whole industry. The modest fashion industry is a $1 trillion industry.
Wow.
Just, yeah, there we go.
Not very modest.
Well, it actually raises a really interesting conversation about the commodification of faith.
Wow.
Absolutely.
And that goes across.
I was going to say, let's talk about LifeWay.
Let's not say that. Let's not go there. Anyway, thank you so much, Susan and Tim, and we'll be back with another podcast soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And just a quick reminder to our listeners to head to eternitynews.com.au/election, where you'll find a range of resources on the issue, including a good summary of where the different parties stand on it all.
I'm Megan Powell-Dutoit and
I'm Michael Jensen.
And we hope you got something good out of that episode of The Good Vote. If you're hungry for more Eternity podcasts, why not give us a go?
Yeah, I think you're going to be hungry, even thirsty for more.
Ours is called With All Due Respect, where we talk about... What do we talk about, Michael?
We talk about lots of stuff. I mean, it's all open slather at With All Due Respect, but it is respectful. It's kind.
And a bit cheeky.
It's a bit cheeky. I think it's fun. It's enjoyable.
We talk about deep theology and popular songs and things like that.